more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
Photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
It is the 20th of October, 2019, and you're tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is just after 7 p.m., and on Sundays, that only means one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Heather Forsyth.
And I'm Lori Lutz. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the host and their guest and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight, we're joined by Shweta Ravisankar. She is a fifth-year PhD candidate in the Cell and Developmental Biology program at the Oregon Health and Sciences University. So we normally interview students only from OSU, but we're having a special episode tonight. Shweta works at the Oregon National Primate Center Research Center affiliated with OSU, and that is within the Division of Reproductive and Developmental Sciences there. We're so happy that you came on the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for making the journey here tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for having me here.
It was a rainy drive, maybe.
Yeah.
It was actually pretty straightforward. And yeah, it was only about an hour and a half. So yeah.
Cool. So, Your research is related to, broader impacts, it's related to in vitro fertilization. So I'm wondering if you can tell us what that is and who would make use of that treatment, and then get into a little bit more about your research.
Sure. So in vitro fertilization, this technique was, it came up like more than 40 years ago now, and in layman terms, we can say that it's about putting the female egg and the male sperm in a dish, let it fertilize, and then transfer it back into the woman's uterus or womb so that the embryo can attach and grow. So who would want to get this done is couples who have been trying to get pregnant for about a year and still are not able to get pregnant. They go to the doctor's office and they say, hey, we are not able to get pregnant. So they get a number of tests done. And when the doctor feels that, yes, probably they are having fertility issues. So that's when they suggest infertility treatments, and IVF or in vitro fertilization is one of those treatments. It's probably not the first treatment that a couple undergoes, maybe the second or third treatment, depending on what their reason for infertility is. It can be caused by female and male factors, and there are also a lot of cases of unexplained infertility of where the doctor or the couple does not understand what's actually happening.
So what are some of the reasons that would cause couples to have problems with getting pregnant and needing in vitro fertilization?
Right. So just not just for in vitro fertilization, but for any infertility treatment. Mm-hmm. From a female factor perspective, it can be that probably she's not ovulating, which means through her period, about the middle of a period, she releases an egg that is capable of fertilization. Some females don't undergo that process, and so there is no ovulation, so no release of eggs. So maybe it's developed in the ovary, but it's not released. So they don't even know that. It might be the quality of eggs is not good. For male factors, it might be that the sperm does not swim as fast to reach the egg to fertilize it, or the sperm count is low, or they're also screening for many genetic reasons because of which the couple could be infertile. So yeah, there are so many more reasons, but yeah.
But your research is looking specifically at some of these causes that influence like with diet and things like that, and that can influence the woman in that way.
So. Yeah. So my research is mainly focused on looking at the ovary and looking at how can we get a good egg, the golden egg that can give us a good quality blastocyst or an embryo that can then implant into the uterus. And I'm looking at a few aspects here. I'm looking at the environment in which that egg develops inside what is called as an ovarian follicle. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the fluid in the follicle and trying to correlate if there are metabolites in the fluid that can indicate what the oocyte is going to do, what the oocyte decides. Do I want to fertilize? Do I not want to fertilize? What it's going to do? And yes, I'm also looking at impact of consumption of high-fat diet for a very short duration, for about 6 to 8 months in rhesus macaque monkeys, of course, and how that impacts the quality of egg and its further development after fertilization. And another aspect that I'm looking at is the long-term impact of a high-fat diet or having high levels of testosterone in the body, and how that will impact at the level of the development of the ovarian follicle or the egg itself. Like, yeah.
So you're looking at these high-fat diets, and that's trying to mimic more of like an American or a Western-style diet. So is that, are you finding that is having a negative impact on fertility?
So there are so many aspects of fertility, right? So, but then, mm-hmm. yes, we are seeing that it is having a negative impact on certain factors. For example, the blastocyst that I keep talking about. So it's after 8 days of development, 6 to 8 days of fertilization post-development in rhesus macaque monkeys, which will be about 5 to 6 days in women. So we do see that the quality or the number of blastocysts that we get after IVF drastically reduces after even short-term consumption of high-fat diet. And I think that's really valuable, because as a couple, when you're undergoing fertility treatments and you go to the clinic, as it is, the success rates are really low. So if the success rates are going to be even lower, as it is, it's only less than 50% or near 40%. So if it's going to be even lower, then it's not good. So I think for a couple, it's better to know if this diet is going to influence their treatment plans or anything like that. Yeah.
So translationally, since you're looking at just a short-term period of eating a high-fat diet, that would mean for us, I guess, that if you've been eating a diet like this for your whole life, but then you stop doing that and you get really healthy and you start eating, you know, not a high fat diet in preparatory reasons for getting pregnant, will this research is showing that maybe doesn't matter. What matters was everything leading up to that point.
So that's a very good question. And we are not doing diet reversal for this project that I'm studying,
okay.
to see mm-hmm. how probably if they go on a standard chow diet, then is this going to be restored to what it was before? That's not something that we're looking at in this project. But The long-term project that I spoke about, the center has plans to do diet reversal for those monkeys. And they've been on this diet for about 5 to 6 years now since they hit their puberty or around that time. So the center does have plans of reversing the diet and looking at if things are going to improve from there or what actually happens. And as a matter of fact, in the IVF clinics, they do suggest a rigorous exercise or diet pattern. Of course, there is nothing sure shot that this is what would happen, but mm-hmm. that's what we are trying to study. Yeah.
So I want to ask you about the monkeys. So you are working at this primate center, which is only one of five in the U.S.,
yeah.
right? So other places have been shut down or maybe there's funding problems. Can you talk about what it's like to work there and what are the monkeys doing, hanging out? Do you hang out with them?
So, yes, it's an amazing place to work in because it's unique. It's a unique mm-hmm. place to work, and you work with the rhesus macaque monkeys, which are so similar to women, at least in reproductive physiology. And so the monkeys are, I don't interact directly with the monkeys, but the animal care staff at our center is extremely well trained to the extent that they know when the monkey is kind of stressed, when it's not, when the monkey, she or he is not behaving properly. Yeah. the monkeys have names, and so it's not like what is it doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like what is love? It's all names, right? It's mm-hmm. today Sam did this, and that's what they're talking. I'm like, who's Sam? Oh, Sam is that monkey. I'm like, oh, okay, all right. Like that's how I felt in the beginning when I joined the center, and then I realized that you need to take care of the monkeys that way, and I mean they need to be comfortable being a part of our research.
Yeah.
It's not that we want this, it's my way or highway. No, it's not mm-hmm. that way. So even to undergo the hormonal stimulations required for the experiments that I do, they need to be trained to show their hand for blood draws and injections.
Oh, okay.
If they don't want it, they don't get it. Like,
wow.
That's
so interesting.
Yeah.
And I imagine that it, you know, keeping the monkeys comfortable and happy also directly influences their reproductive success.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've seen this back in our center, and others have also reported this, that if they're probably stressed, then probably our outcomes are not as good. And that's fine if it's like one monkey, we don't get some kind of result from her, but then if that's happening over like repetitively, then we know that probably they don't want this kind of treatment right now, and they want to be more trained and more comfortable with all this. Yeah, but then if you come to our center, and we need to have prior permission from the animal care staff and the facility, but then we can we get to tour a particular segment of the center where we see where the monkeys are and how they're playing, and they have their own open ground to play, and it's really relaxing in a sense to you know just see that it's really nice. Yeah.
Cool. So walk us through your actual research, big picture, and what you do on a day-to-day basis. So you actually work with two different labs, and the monkeys, they get a hormonal treatment, you get their eggs, and then what?
Yeah, so they go through a hormonal treatment similar to what a woman would go through in an IVF clinic. After that, we collect their eggs. And after we collect their eggs, I do IVF with the egg and the sperm. And then I let them develop for the first 6 or 8 days, depending on which day they form a blastocyst. So one cool thing is that in this time frame of development, after fertilization, we mostly add them to time-lapse scope. And so when we put them on the time-lapse scope, the scope clicks pictures every 5 minutes of development, and then we compile a video of it. And that's really important because we are able to see after the development that did they have any morphological things that we need to note about, like, for example, did they fragment while dividing, or was there multipolar division, which happens usually a cell would divide from 1 to 2 and then 2 to 3 and 3 to 4, but sometimes it happens that it just goes from 1 to 3 or 1 to 4 directly. So in those cases, we try to freeze the sample down and then later do sequencing analysis to see if a multipolar division or a fragmented division has caused any like chromosomal abnormalities, or by DNA sequencing and RNA sequencing to check what kind of genes are upregulated or downregulated. So this is the molecular biology aspect of after we've collected the samples. And we, of course, for this 8 days, we check how many cleaved, how many formed a blastocyst. So blastocyst formation rates and those things are really important for our research and also in translationally in the clinics.
So you're really looking at, you're trying to find the good egg and doing that part specifically. By the way, if you're interested in seeing an image of these blastocysts, we weren't able to upload the video, but we do have a screenshot of the blastocysts up on the blog, so you should totally check that out.
So you're really getting a big picture of development and fertilization, because you start with the eggs, you see them in the dish, and then you see the morphology of them, what the whole cells look like, what the monkeys look like, how healthy they are. And then you also get down into a really, really small, like, molecular basis, DNA, RNA, maybe, whatever else, very small things. And so I want to know how you feel that is beneficial, as opposed to narrowing in maybe more, even more specifically on one time shot of fertilization and development.
So, as I mentioned, IVF success rates are already pretty low.
Right.
Right. And there are many, there is a lot of research out there looking at the embryo quality after fertilization and which one they can transfer and which one they can't. So we are looking at the time point at the very beginning when we collect the oocytes itself. So the success rate can decrease at any point during this entire process. Our goal here is to look at the competency of the egg itself and in a non-invasive manner. So we are not actually doing anything to the egg or the developing embryo, but we want to look at the fluid in which it literally bathes during development. So it communicates with the fluid that I want this nutrients, I don't want this anymore, like, what's going on? So if we get the fluid from that follicle, then we feel like we can determine maybe a pathway or a particular set of metabolites that say that, hey, I'm present in the follicular fluid because my egg did not develop well and they did not use me, or they used this pathway and that's why I'm present here, and look, my egg did this. So we are comparing the fluid to the corresponding follicle oocyte or egg development. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's really very beneficial looking at the entire gamut, because we know that what was there and what that egg became. So it's like looking at the entire spectrum. And I'm really fortunate that I'm a part of two labs that work on the different aspects, but similar things, right? Mm-hmm. So Hannibal's lab looks at the ovary and studies what is important for ovulation, or what is important for ovulation of a good egg. And Shava's lab studies. So after I fertilize the egg, what is happening during that development? Are there any chromosomal abnormalities? Are there any morphological abnormalities? So by being a student in both these labs, I get to look at what I was and what I become later, the entire story of the egg, you know? Mm-hmm. I hope that answers your question. Yeah,
I want to ask you kind of a hard question.
Okay.
So if we, let's say we figure out all the metabolites that make the best egg, so how will that impact women choosing to go IVF, go through IVF, or maybe donating eggs, or maybe companies that make metabolites maybe could supplement the eggs? What do you think the maybe bigger long-term down the road impacts of finding out what a perfect egg should look like?
Right. So if we have in mind a set of metabolites, or if you're really lucky, one metabolite, I don't think that's going to happen, but like a set of pathways that need to be upregulated at a certain level in the follicular fluid for the egg to become good. If we are able to figure that out, then the ultimate goal would be like an insulin test where you just punch it in your skin and you're able to see the level of insulin. Mm-hmm. At the time of oocyte collection, we can do a quick assay, like an ELISA kind of assay in the follicular fluid for that particular metabolite or metabolites, and know their exact concentration or the range of the concentration, and decide if this egg is going to give a viable embryo that can be then transferred or not. So what happens is, in this, you can reduce the number of eggs that you're going to fertilize, which will also reduce the cost, increase the success of IVF. So a couple that's undergoing IVF will not feel that you got 20 eggs from me, or I don't know, 10 eggs from me, and fertilized all of them, but I got only 2 embryos at the end. Right, then it's not that feeling, because it's a huge financial and emotional burden on a couple that's undergoing IVF. So that is one aspect of it. And the other aspect of it is, this is something that I'm just thinking about as we are talking, right? So girls who have cancer treatment at a very young age. Nowadays, as I'm saying nowadays, because now it's becoming more aware that you can do fertility preservation. So maybe those eggs at that point, when you've not even hit puberty, are immature. So if you know what are the things in the follicular fluid that might have caused the eggs to mature properly and form a competent egg, maybe when they want to get pregnant later in their life after their treatments, if their ovarian tissue was preserved, then probably the follicle can be grown in a media containing those metabolites to yield a better egg.
Sure.
That's so fascinating. I don't think I really realized that young girls who were, you know, maybe planning to get pregnant later in life, I mean, that's probably not something they're considering at that point, but having that option that before undergoing treatment, that their immature eggs are preserved.
Yeah, right. They are preserved. So there is like...
Treatment kills the eggs,
right? Treatment kills all cells. So there is no guarantee that anything's going to be preserved. So yeah, it's in fact, a group at our center is now researching if you preserve immature eggs, and if you transplant it elsewhere in the body or something, is it able to become a mature egg? And it's really cool to see the kind of research. Very, a very sad situation, but it's if we are able to help those kind of situations, I think that would be great.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's shift gears a bit and talk about your dancing, because you spend a lot of time in the lab, but you also teach dance.
Yes.
And love it. So, and you have a performance that's coming up really soon, right? This coming weekend.
Yeah.
tell us about that.
Okay, cool. So... this is a part that I'm always excited to talk about. dance and science have gone hand in hand for me. I'm really passionate about both of them. So dance, I'm an Indian classical dancer, and the dance form that I perform, learn, perform, teach is Bharatanatyam. So the performance that I'm going to be doing is, I got a residency fellowship from an organization called New Expressive Works in Portland. And so we have four choreographers who will be presenting at this performance, a 20-minute piece each. So
it's a long dance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So usually my performances are 1.5 hours. So.
Oh, wow.
But then I'm really excited about this piece. It's very special for me because I'll be performing on depression. The topic of my performance is depression, the new old emotion, because it feels like it's new when I'm talking to somebody. They're like, oh, really? Does all this happen? And I felt the need to do this because I personally went through a depression-like state when I moved to Portland in 2015 and I started graduate school. There was a lot going on at that point, and plus unknown city, no friends, a lot of coursework. The weather did not help. Yeah. I moved here in September and then it started raining and it became dark. And so, yeah, so I went through a tough phase at that point, and I did not know if it was okay to talk to anyone about it. So I did not talk to my sisters, my family, my parents. I did not talk to anybody about it, especially because I know growing up in India, it's a big taboo topic. They just say it'll be fine, just carry on with life, right? And I saw that's the scene here also for many people, but I was really fortunate that OHSU has a very good behavioral health department in which we can go and talk to people. So yes, I went through a very tough phase the first quarter, and at that point, then I started talking to my family about it. I went and spoke to my advisor about it, and I told her that this is becoming very difficult for me. And I personally did not want to go on medications for depression. I'm not saying it's good or bad, or everyone's choice is everyone's choice, but then I did not want to. So I had a very tough fight against depression. Daily morning I used to tell myself, it's fine, I'm going to be all right, it's going to be all right. And I literally had to push myself to get out of the house. And so this dance is very special for me in informing people that what a person might go through from my perspective, and that it's important to be supportive. It's important to say it'll be all right, but not make that person feel that it'll be all right, so I don't understand what you're doing. Like,
right.
That is not the feeling that one wants. So, yeah.
Sure. If you want to read more about Shweta's journey with depression, she has shared with us several blogs that she's written, and we have links to those on the blog as well.
And I think especially as, you know, fellow graduate students and being in this high pressure environment, that this is something that is very relatable to a lot of people. I mean, even undergraduates, and I guess a lot of other people too outside of academia. Yeah. So, and you mentioned, you know, having really great resources at OHSU. Yeah. And I just want to say that we also have really great resources here at OSU. So if listeners out there aren't aware of those, you can look into CAPS, and we have a lot of really great programs that I know a lot of people that utilize those here. So
nice.
Would
nice.
Recommend.
Yes.
That's nice. And it always helps to have advisors who are willing to listen to you and help you through it.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. So we didn't really touch on your background before coming to OHSU. So can you tell us a little bit how you ended up here at OHSU?
Sure. So starting from the beginning.
Yeah.
I loved biology growing up. I loved biology and math, and I chose to stick to biology. because that does not bring physics with it. So, but yeah, I love biology. And then, so I, fast forwarding to my college life, I picked to do BTech in biotechnology. And so there I learned about industrial biotech and various aspects, animal, plant biology. And I realized that I'm really interested in zoology, or mainly human anatomy and human physiology. I was very mm-hmm. much interested in those classes. So after my BTech, I worked in a molecular biology lab to understand more about, so what are the kind of projects going on now in this area, and what are people doing. So I did basic molecular biology, PCR and DNA extraction and mm-hmm. all that, and learned all that. And then I decided to do my master's in biotech, in medical biotechnology. And that's where I learned more about stem cells and fertilization and embryo development, like all theory about it. And I was mm-hmm. really fascinated with stem cells, the idea that it can keep growing. It's amazing. And then it can decide one day that I want to become the cell, and that one day is not a random day, it has to be properly functioned. I was like, how does it know what's going on? And then I realized that that's what happens after fertilization. It's a bunch of cells that's just multiplying, and then one day it knows that I want to be this part of the body or that mm-hmm. part of the body. And so it really fascinated me, it blew my mind. So after that, I worked at a stem cell banking company in their research and development, and I did a few projects on a type of stem cell called mesenchymal stem cells. And then at that time, a lot of my family and friends were undergoing fertility treatments. And so this entire embryology aspect of theory that I had learned, I was seeing what's happening, not at the embryo development stage, but then it really impacted me. And I was like, I want to learn more about this. So I approached a fertility clinic and I did an internship over there for about 6 months to understand what exactly happens, how the couples feel, or what's going on in the clinic side of it, and when they transfer the embryos and stuff like that. And so after that, I applied for a master's at San Jose State University over here. So before this, all my education was in India. And after this, I applied for this master's, which had the option of doing a year-long internship funded by California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. So in the 2 years of master's, I finished my coursework in a year. And then the second year, I worked at Stanford in the Sebastiano lab. And Dr. Vittorio Sebastiano, he introduced me to the world of embryology in practical use, right? I'd only read about it. So that's where I actually worked with, actually thought an embryo under the scope. And I was like, I was just amazed to look at the oocyte or a three cell or a blastocyst. I was like, wow. And I think that is the point where I was like, we come from this one cell, like one cell becomes so many cells, and we are studying this entire body and everything is so different. I was just super fascinated by that. And I decided to do my PhD at that point. I always wanted to do it, but then before joining that internship program, I was like, maybe I should just go start a job after this and stop studying after all. But then I was like so inspired, and I was like, no, I want to do a PhD. So I applied to labs that specifically work in this kind of research area, and that's where I met Dr. Sean Chavez, in whose lab I am right now. And she introduced me to Dr. John Hennebolt, and they had a project which I could be a part of. And yeah, in these past 4 years, I think I've been a part of many projects in those labs, and they've been really encouraging. So yeah, that's been my journey, and I look forward to being in this field of infertility or fertility research if possible. And yeah, and have my dance company and dance. So.
Amazing.
A very well-balanced life, I see for you.
I don't know if it's that. I struggle between the two, but then it's fine. Yeah, with family support, it's all good.
Good. Well, we have two traditions on our show, and the first one is for you to give us a bit of advice. So this can be for your former self, for undergraduates, graduate students, people in the community, whoever that might be. And so go ahead and tell us who your advice is for and what advice you have.
Yeah. So advice more out of experience, I don't know. So it is definitely for my former self. It is also for anybody who's listening, actually. It's not for like a specific set of people. Just that be content, be satisfied with what you have. Like, try to reach a stage where you feel like, I'm happy with what I have. Yes, I want to achieve XYZ more things, but I'm also happy with what I have. Because if we keep thinking that, oh, I don't have this, oh, I don't have that all the time, then it's just going to increase your anxiety. And I always joke that anxiety and depression are like my two sides who are sitting on the side, and I don't even know when they creep into me. And so we need to be aware to just keep them away. So just try to be satisfied with what you have, and they'll keep knocking on you and they can't get into you.
I think that's great advice. Our second tradition is to pick a song. So tell us about the song you chose and why you picked it.
Yeah. So the song that I chose is a Hindi song. It is Kisi Ki Muskurahaton Pe Ho Nisar. And it basically says Jeena Isi Ka Naam Hai, which means this is how you live. And it says, help others. If you see someone else smiling, be happy for them. I am not very rich by money, materialistically, but I'm very rich in my thoughts. Try to be rich in your thoughts. It's a very happy song. If you look at the video, it won't look that happy, but then the guy is actually like, I'm very happy in my life and I want to be happy in my life, like that kind of song. So it's my go-to song whenever I want to cheer up or something. I'm like, yeah, I mean, life is not bad. Why am I thinking life is bad? Life is great. So, yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you one more time for coming down from Portland, coming on the show. It's been really good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, tell your friends about it and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at KBVRID.
This theme music was performed by the OSU Drumline, and the intro jingle was created by Olin Haman. Special thanks to the supporting staff at KBVR that allow the show and podcast to be possible.
This show was started by Jean Kamvar and Joey Hulbert in 2012. To learn about our current hosts, other graduate students at Oregon State, or if you want to be part of the show, visit our website at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. Thanks again for listening, and stay curious, my friends.